uncertain landscape we've found ourselves in has inspired this conversation to get to the other side. Sure, we want to get there, but can we move in a way that's deeply woven with our whole selves, one another, and the deepest threads of this fabric of existence? This week, we had some slight technical difficulty from our backyard recording studio, but are still excited for Katie Schala-Lashak and Bjorn Westgaard to share this riveting discussion on, believe it or not, data, and the hope it can reveal to help us get to the other side.
My name is Bjorn Westgaard. I am an emergency physician and a researcher, and do some teaching with med students and residents and such. I work at Health Partners, a variety of hospitals, primarily Regions. And I have really been kind of struggling with everything that's been going on, from COVID to the continuously, but now re-highlighted in our own community, issues of racism and systemic inequalities. And I've really been struggling with, you know, what can I do? What can I put my hands to?
I'm Katie Schala-Lashak. I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner. And my background in terms of work is working in primary care at Children's for about 10 years, and then working with the Minnesota Department of Health for a bunch of years after that, and now I'm working as a school nurse. And I know a lot of you are probably not super excited about the idea of data, but Bjorn and I are going to talk about how data and measuring stuff really helps us understand better where we are. And especially in times of, I guess I would call it turmoil, like today, help us reimagine where we might want to be and what specifically can we do action-wise collectively to get to the other side.
Yeah, I think we would really like to talk about the kind of the systems, the institutions we're a part of, but also our personal data, our stories that we're a part of, and how we can keep tabs on it and see how we can change it. So at work, we do a lot of measuring, right? So we at the hospital, we measure time to getting an ER room and time in the department and who gets what, and
you know, how does it turn out, I'm guessing.
Does it turn out? Outcomes for things like sepsis and trauma and heart attacks and strokes. And one of the things that institutions and healthcare have not historically paid attention to is issues of race and other equity concerns. And so I have really tried to dig in terms of improving what we do on those fronts and actually sort of measuring and looking at things with an equity lens. And that's actually been sort of the focus of my background in medicine, is I've put a lot of effort into researching what are often termed disparities, although I think what we really want to get at is doing things right, and we really want to talk about doing good care as opposed to gaps and lacks and things like that in care.
And I guess when you say that, disparities is kind of the end result. We see this disparate result by race in particular is what we're talking about today versus the systems and the conditions that actually contribute to those disparities. So equities of systems or inequity of the system.
Absolutely. I mean, those, you know, data are the outcome of a whole set of processes. And yeah. So following them, and trying to improve upon them really points the finger at everything that produced them. Yeah. And what do we need to do?
So this all sounds great, but like in your work, what have you actually identified, and have you, based on that work, have you actually been able to make some changes?
Yeah, so this is now a number of years ago, had looked at pain control in the emergency department and who got pain medicine and how long it took them to get pain medicine. As you might imagine, you know, pain control is like a essential thing that we do for a large number of people who come through the door of the emergency department. And so we actually stratified that by gender and race and age to see who got pain medicine and who didn't. What we found was that Black people got pain medicine less often. than white people. And it was statistically significant. So it was not a chance that it was random, mm-hmm. right? And we looked at other, racial categories, sort of census racial categories, and found that there wasn't a difference for other categories, but that for black folks, it was significant. You're familiar with codes.
Yep.
We have a code red for stroke, code red for mm-hmm. heart attack, code okay. red for those things. And we instituted a code red for pain control, which meant that if somebody came in and we had a sense that they were in significant pain, you could call that and someone would get them pain medicine quickly. And we analyzed the data for 6 months, year after that, and the disparity actually went away. Hmm. There was no longer sort of a systemic statistical difference. Somebody here or there might still not get pain medicine or might still, wait for a while for pain medicine. But as a systems issue, it was not systematically a pattern of inequality.
Right. And I think that's a really great example. If you hadn't measured it, you wouldn't have necessarily identified. You might have heard stories, like anecdotes, of it being an issue, but you wouldn't know that it was a systemic issue unless you specifically measured and looked at the data and then tracked over time to see, by tracking data, that's how you know if you've made a difference. And that's really motivating, too, to keep looking at other things and seeing where changes could be made.
One of the things that you will often hear is that if you're not measuring it, you can't improve it. Which is not quite true, but from a systems perspective, whether you're in a school or a business or a hospital, it allows you to see patterns and to try to do something about them.
Right.
And I think it's given sort of all of our habits in these institutions that we're a part of, sometimes it helps us figure out what we can do.
Yeah.
So one of the folks who has helped me think about this and actually kind of helped me look at what we can do when we're talking about issues of like policing inequities, which we're very aware of recently, is a guy by the name of Philip Atiba Goff. And he runs the Center for Policing Equity. And he calls himself a justice nerd,
which I like that.
Is
that might be the best kind of nerd.
I have one of his shirts. It says justice nerd.
Awesome.
Because it's about like how do we use these data systems that are sort of omnipresent?
Yeah.
To do justice.
Yeah.
And so I've got a great clip. Where he kind of talks about it and how it really helps you get at what can we do? How can we solve these inequalities that we see?
Yeah.
All of my research and the decade of work I've done with my center, the Center for Policing Equity, actually leads me to a hopeful conclusion amidst all the heartbreak of race in America, which is this. Trying to solve racism feels impossible because our definition of racism makes it impossible. But it doesn't have to be that way. So here's what I mean. The most common definition of racism is that racist behaviors are the product of contaminated hearts and minds. And when you listen to the way we talk about trying to cure racism, you'll hear it. Right? We need to stamp out hatred. We need to combat ignorance. Right? It's hearts and minds. Now, the only problem with that definition is that it's completely wrong, both scientifically and otherwise. One of the foundational insights of social psychology is that attitudes are very weak predictors of behaviors. But more importantly than that, no black community has ever taken to the streets to demand that white people would love us more. Communities march to stop the killing because racism is about behaviors, not feelings. And even when civil rights leaders like King and Fannie Lou Hamer used the language of love, the racism they fought, that was segregation and brutality. It's actions over feelings. And every one of those leaders would agree, if a definition of racism makes it harder to see the injuries racism causes, that's not just wrong. A definition that cares about the intentions of abusers more than the harms to the abused, that definition of racism is racist. But when we change the definition of racism, from attitudes to behaviors, we transform that problem from impossible to solvable. Because you can measure behaviors. And when you can measure a problem, you can tap into one of the only universal rules of organizational success. You got a problem or a goal, you measure it, you hold yourself accountable to that metric. So if every other organization measures success this way, why can't we do that in policing? It turns out we actually already do. Police departments already practice data-driven accountability, it's just for crime. Like the vast majority of police departments across the United States use a system called CompStat. It's a process that, when you use it right, it identifies crime data, it tracks it and identifies patterns, and then it allows departments to hold themselves accountable to public safety goals, right? It usually works either by directing police attentions, right, and police resources, or changing police behavior once they show up. So if I see a string of muggings in that neighborhood, I'm gonna wanna increase patrols in that neighborhood. If I see a spike in homicides, I'm gonna wanna talk to the community to find out why and collaborate on changes on police behavior to tamp down the violence. Now, when you define racism in terms of measurable behaviors, you can do the same thing. You can create a CompStat for justice. And that's exactly what the Center for Policing Equity has been doing. So let me tell you how that works. After a police department invites us in, we handle the legal stuff, we engage with the community, our next step is to analyze their data. And the goal of these analyses is to determine how much do crime, poverty, neighborhood demographics predict, let's say, police use of force. Okay? So let's say that those factors predict police will use force on this many black people. There? So our next question is, how many black people actually are targeted for police use of force? Let's say it's this many. So what's up with the gap? Well, a big portion of the gap is the difference between what's predicted by things police can't control and what's predicted by things police can control, their policies and their behaviors. And what we're looking for are the types of contact or the areas in the city where that gap is biggest. Because then we can tell our partners, look here, solve this problem first. It's actually the kind of therapy police chiefs can get behind, because there is nothing so inspiring in the face of our history of racism as a solvable problem.
So when I hear Dr. Atiba Goff...
otherwise known as Dr. Phil.
Dr. Phil, that's right. He's my Dr. Phil. When I hear him talk, it really makes me feel like there is something that we can do, even though we may not have a natural entree into these issues. A lot of us participate in institutions where we are tracking these things. And the systems that we can see the broken parts of, we can try to help put together in other ways so that they are, you know, we may recognize that they're broken, but maybe that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can try to work on designing them so that the things that we're tracking and the things that we're improving actually work to break patterns of inequality and to make spaces where our implicit biases aren't the sort of dominant force in interactions.
Yeah. And so just summarize for me, what was his closing line? Because I heard him talking about it's not just about your beliefs, your assumptions, your attitudes. It's really about behaviors.
Well, we really care about outcomes, right?
Yeah.
We really, and that's what... tracking outcomes is the important thing. And the thing about tracking outcomes is if you measure it and you can then get an eye towards what's going on, then it potentially becomes solvable. And he
right.
said there's nothing more inspiring
yeah.
than a solvable problem. I love that.
Yeah, me too. It's actually motivating instead of overwhelming.
Yeah, because it can. Yeah. You can just feel like it. Where do I start?
Yeah. So I want to share just a little bit from my work perspective, and then we're going to bring it a little bit closer to home in terms of personal daily interactions that maybe all of us can relate to. But I wanted to share a couple of things about... So for example, when I worked at the Department of Health, my focus was on child health and development. And so I had an opportunity to look at data from all across the state about whatever kind of health or educational outcome we were interested in, whether it's the likelihood of babies dying within a year of birth or having developmentally healthy outcomes and being ready for kindergarten or whatever. So a whole range of health issues. And the thing that became very clear to me after 8 years of working there was that almost on every single measure, we found that African-American, so American-born Black and Indigenous children had the greatest disparities by race in virtually every outcome. And so we spent a lot of time thinking, you know, at the state level, what kind of policies could we put in place? What kind of actual action could we take? So we looked at, like, how do we grant money to community organizations and changing the way that we... So how do we find a way to, with good accountability and transparency, have grant opportunities where the money doesn't go to the best writers, it goes to the greatest need and the people in the community who can actually change, most effectively change outcomes for children in families, you know, of color. But if you look at data, you can easily find the differences by race, which is discouraging. But there aren't a ton of examples of us taking data to a point where we've actually changed that inequity, like you described in the ER. So it's great to hear that example. I was talking to a friend who works in California, and he shared with me some data from Kaiser, which you've probably heard of. It's a huge healthcare organization out in California.
Yeah, one of the biggest in the country.
The biggest in the country. So they spend a lot of time looking at quality improvement. And one graph in this 40-slide PowerPoint presentation stood out to me, and that was where they showed by race blood pressure control, so how well patients coming in actually had their blood pressure under control. And so over about an 8 or 10-year period, all race groups were kind of tracking more or less together, except for African-American adults were way lower at the beginning, and then over time, through a series of very intentional changes, they were able to change the trajectory, so change the pattern to where there was still a difference, but it wasn't this dramatic difference between African American adults and other adults. But the interesting thing about all the other slides is they didn't focus a lot on giving better medication. They focused a lot on how do doctors talk to patients. And it's really about getting at what is going on with this individual person and what is their motivation and what's their experience in life. So the focus wasn't on changing patients. It was changing clinicians. Mm-hmm. And how they interacted with patients. So I know you all are probably totally bored because Bjorn and I really like talking about data and quality improvement and all that stuff. But let me just highlight a couple other things before we bring it around to kind of a more personal level. When I was looking at that Kaiser data, the interesting thing is, aside from the fact that they were able to actually really improve that inequity and how they related to patients by race, the other thing I noticed that was not so great, they showed Black or African-American, they showed Asian or Pacific Islander, Hispanic or Latino, and white, but there was no mention of American Indian. And in Minnesota and around the country, American Indian kids and families and adults are experiencing the greatest, worst effects of our systemic inequities.
Particularly with COVID recently.
And COVID, I think, has basically been a spotlight on our mm-hmm. inequities. And the reason that this happens is because over the last few hundred years, since Europeans came to this land, we've had really effective policies around initially genocide and assimilation to the point where a really large population got to a really tiny number. And so when you're looking at data, the problem with looking at data is it's great when you have lots of people, but American Indians are somewhere around 1 or 2% of the population, depending on where you are. The numbers are super low. So unless you are intentional, you're not going to see what's going on with American Indian families.
I have seen that at the hospital as well, where you just don't have the numbers where you can show significance, and it's very difficult to track also because people are not always identifying or telling you these things. And so figuring out better ways to interact so that you can actually know who people are is a really tough thing, but something that's really vital to what we're doing and is part of that whole process that produces better outcomes. But we can talk about that in a little bit.
Okay. I guess bringing it too to something very specific in Minneapolis, the University of Minnesota actually did, it wasn't a perfect, but it was a very robust study on autism in Minnesota, and it really focused mostly on the metro area. And in that study, we learned that Somali and white children were identified at about the same rate if you just look at statistical significance, but African-American kids were underidentified, but we have no idea about American Indian kids because, again, the number was too small.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can make the assumption based on everything else we know that we don't do as good of a job for American Indian kids either at identifying developmental delays or autism and then therefore being able to actually provide services for that.
Well, and that kind of goes to that point I was saying where we talk about if you're not measuring it, you can't fix it. But
right.
There are some times when you know that there are problems,
you know,
and
enough.
They don't show up in the data.
Yeah.
But you know enough mm-hmm. to triangulate and say, we need to focus on this.
Yeah. Yep. So data isn't perfect, but it sure helps.
It's a start.
All right, so we've been talking about data and particularly about not having a lot of data on American Indian people in terms of health and that's a lot of times just because the number is small. And so we don't get so-called statistically significant information or we're not measuring things. So this makes me think about Abigail Echohawk, who is a researcher. She describes herself as a storyteller.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So she works for the Seattle Indian Health Board, and she's the director and the chief researcher at the Urban Indian Health Institute. So since she came into that position, they had different regional urban Indian research centers, but she brought together nationwide. And their institute looks at urban American Indian folks across the nation. Their job is basically to make sure that that story gets told. So just recently, after George Floyd's death, she did a kind of a brief webinar with a Seattle congressperson, and it was about COVID, but she ended up talking about the need for data around police violence. And so this is just a brief clip in her voice as she emphasizes that need.
We urge, and this is something I'm very dedicated to, we definitely urge federal agencies, local jurisdictions, and states to add death or injury by legal police intervention to their list of reportable conditions of death in the CDC. And what that means is right now, those deaths by police brutality are not being captured in the way that they should in the federal reporting data systems. And that lack of data is very important. And so I just want to say that we stand with our Black brothers and sisters, that the Indigenous community is in solidarity with them, and we stand with them as they fight to ensure the safety and the well-being of their people.
Okay, so she's talking about the importance of collecting data on things that we need to learn about. So in her own words, I'm reading from an interview with her. She says, we're always being shown as statistically insignificant. Imagine, as a people, what that can feel like year after year after year. So back in her words, our responsibility as a tribal epidemiology system is make sure that our people are represented in the data. When we think about data, how it's been gathered is that from marginalized communities, it's never gathered to help or serve us. It's primarily done to show the deficits in our communities and to show where there are gaps. And that's really what we've been talking about, is the disparities. So back to Abigail again. Sorry, I keep breaking my own thoughts here.
It's okay.
this is always done from a deficit-based framework. They talk about how our community has the highest rates of obesity, the highest rates of diabetes, highest rates of infant mortality. What they don't talk about is the strengths of our community. What we know, particularly for Indigenous people, is that there was a genocide and assimilation policies and termination policies that were perpetuated against us. If it had worked, we wouldn't be here. And so we were always strengths-based people who passed on continued knowledge systems, regardless of people who tried to destroy us. And then she says, I always think about the data as story, and each person who contributed to that data as storytellers. What is our responsibility to the story and our responsibility to the storyteller? These are all Indigenous concepts that we always care for our storytellers, and we always have a responsibility to our stories.
I love that language of family. Obviously, she's a strong voice and she struck you. What do you take from that?
Well, one thing that was interesting to me in my work was when I was talking to other people who do similar things that I do in Seattle, they ended up changing how they did their adolescent health assessment. And so instead of just focusing on sex and drug use, they looked at family connection and at other strengths and supports that young people have. And so what they learned when they actually focused on that data is that American Indian youth actually had higher rates of family connection in the community compared to other groups. And so it's just an example of, yes, we should be addressing inequities, but we also really need to pay attention to what are the strengths, what are the assets that people bring. So that's the most important thing that I learned from listening to her so far.
Yeah, and I think that is something that data often misses, because mm-hmm. like in healthcare, we're a system that's set up to fix stuff.
Yeah.
Right? So if we're fixing stuff, it's broken. It's wrong. It's a gap. It's like busted. And so we're not used to how do we recognize strengths and build on them inside the clinical setting and outside the clinical setting.
Let's talk about outside the clinical or a little bit more on the personal level.
Yeah. And that is one of the ways I think that we can all show up, even if we're not involved in, you know, systems, or we're not focusing on metrics, or we don't have the position where we're doing that stuff. All of those interactions that we have on a daily basis are kind of like our own personal data, these stories. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a data nerd, a common statement is that the plural of anecdote is not data, but I think it's very true that every data point represents sort of an aspect or an outcome of a story.
Yeah.
And those stories, who people are, those are what we remember most and really is what's oftentimes the most important thing. So even if we're not changing systems, we can change some of these stories.
Yeah, and change how we see those stories.
So, Katie, you work with a lot of students and families on a regular basis. Do you have stories that kind of come to mind?
I do have stories that come to mind. And I have a few too many stories, because I'm going to share a few stories that reminded me of the assumptions I walk into a room with. And so I call these my own little data points of I'm trying to unlearn the things that I learned growing up, the assumptions that I've developed over time about what your appearance or your gender or your age or your language means about who you are and what you're interested in, what you do. So working in the school-based clinic in the past or working in the school now, one example is I speak Spanish, so I work with a lot of Latino families. And we had, I think of one mom in particular. I really enjoyed my interactions with her. She's from Ecuador. But I realized that I had a tendency when I saw these families from Ecuador, after seeing a number of them, I had kind of developed a story of who these people are and what their experience has been. Otherwise, perhaps known as a generalization or a stereotype, I guess, based mm-hmm. on my few data points that I had. So I was talking to her and assuming she was un or undereducated, poor, etc. And as I talked with her more, I learned that she had a PhD in theology. And that completely shifted how I thought about her. And that was a moment where I was like, that's a data point that indicates a need for change.
Yeah.
And so I feel like what I'm learning every day when I walk into a room and have an interaction with a student, a family, a whoever, or in personal conversations with someone that I don't know well, is to pause and to come in with curiosity and recognize when those assumptions come.
Katie, I think that's a great story that makes me think about the interactions that we have as a profession, whether it's docs, nurses, or other folks in the hospital or the clinic. with patients and actually each other too, where there may be all sorts of assumptions, behaviors, language that we use that is worth thinking about and retraining yourself about. Mm-hmm. We oftentimes have talked about cultural competence in healthcare, but it's probably the wrong term because it sort of assumes that, like, I'm going to know about all these things coming in the door.
I've got it figured out.
You're Ecuadorian. And really what is more important is this idea of humility, which I think is also a really key concept in anti-racist action, where you realize I probably get this wrong. I do and say things that could be racist, and I need to fix that. And just accepting that that is probably the case.
Yeah. So going back to Phil.
Right. Going back to
Dr. Phil. It's about behaviors.
It's about behaviors. Mm-hmm. And being willing and able to sort of recognize them and keep tabs on them and potentially change them.
Yeah.
That's where that sort of data look that I was talking about earlier translates into, like, how do you change these things? And so we try to do trainings on in the hospital on, like, cultural humility and other aspects of microaggressions and how do you recognize and respond to them. But oftentimes I feel like it's incumbent upon us just, like, to take this on as a personal goal, a personal thing that we're going to do.
Yeah. And when you say microaggressions, I feel instantly like the hair raising up just a little bit, just with that word. But it's really just about, again, noticing what assumptions do we make when we're interacting with someone.
I had a situation where I came onto a shift and there was a new med student starting his rotation. And I said, "Oh, where are you from?" And what I meant was, what med school are you rotating from? Because we get, this time of year, people who come from all over the country. And he said, "I'm from Minnesota." And I realized in that moment that he heard that question. He had heard that question before. And he had probably heard that question before, you know, in this sort of manner that would imply, like, "You're not from here," or "You don't belong here. Mm-hmm. Where are you from?" And I quickly tried to, I realized how he heard that question. I said, I'm very sorry. I just wanted to know what med school you were from. Glad to be working with you." it's just one of those, it's a small question. Where are you from? But it's one of these things that in the, you know, you hear it completely differently when you are aware and trying to keep tabs on things.
And I think that's a great example. Like, it doesn't mean that we have to be walking on ice all day long to not say the wrong thing. But every time that something happens that makes us feel a little stupid or queasy inside after we've said it, it's an opportunity to do something. And so, like, just, I was at a party, I met a young Black man, and he said, "Yeah, I'm here with my wife," and he pointed across the room. And I, so I walked over, and I saw this young Black woman sitting across the room, so I introduced myself and said, "Hi, I'm Katie, I just met your husband," and I pointed back over, and she's like, "Oh, that's not my husband, that's her husband," and she pointed to a white woman across the table. And I had just automatically assumed, because this is a Black man, that his wife was the only Black woman in the room. And I just felt really stupid. And so what I said at that time was like, "Oh, wow, I really jumped to conclusions on that one." And she just laughed. And I still felt stupid. And I recognized that I had made an assumption. It wasn't a dangerous or deadly assumption, but it was an assumption. And I could see it kind of piling one more little thing to other assumptions she had experienced. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I could just imagine that. But we have an opportunity to just recognize those things when they happen and pause and say, "Okay, where did that come from?"
Yeah.
And what does it mean?
And I think oftentimes being willing to sit in that discomfort for a little while is important.
Yeah.
And as we try to get to the other side on things, it may mean that the other side is rather than having things be pat and in certain patterns and certain mm-hmm. stories, that there we may sit in uncomfortable spaces for long periods of time, because that's where the work happens.
Yeah.
So one of those uncomfortable things, and I'm just going to say it, is that this entire conversation is from the viewpoint of two white people.
Yep.
We have made zero commentary on our race or privilege to this point, but let's just say it. I mean, we're both two white middle-class professionals who are talking about this.
And both of us only know what we know from our perspective. Okay, so we've been talking a lot about systems, data, personal data. I just want to acknowledge that as data consumers, we've all seen examples where statistics can be used to prove whatever point you want to make. Just like a Bible verse can oftentimes be used to prove whatever your moral stance on something is. And so I think as we're talking about data, we're not talking about using data to prove something that you've already decided is true. We're talking about using data to really dig in to learn more about what's actually happening.
Yeah, I think when data is done right, it often confounds simple stories. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of simple stories that we think are true, and we want to find the data that proves those. But when we look at data, we should think about if it's a little too neat. Who's being counted?
Yeah.
Is there other things that need to be measured?
Yeah. And like we've talked about, whose stories are missing. And as we're looking at the data, how are we using it to tell a story? Are we really only talking about deficits? Are we recognizing the strengths that we can see? Are we looking for the strengths?
And when we go into personal interactions, are we also really thinking about engaging with who somebody is as opposed to the problems they may have?
Mm-hmm. On a personal level.
On a personal level.
The reason we're talking about data as a story is helping us to get to the other side. So helping us better define where are we. Pausing for a second to look at, okay, but is that the whole story? Are we missing? Whose important voices are we missing? And then how can we use that data to help imagine a different future? And we're in a really important place right now. COVID has shown a spotlight on a lot of inequities around healthcare. Through George Floyd's death, we've been forced to really face as a community and beyond what is happening, and we're imagining a different future. But how do we use data to not just define where we are, but help us hold us accountable and track us getting to the other side, that reimagined place where we would rather be?
So do you have some thoughts on how people can, some homework or things that people can do in the upcoming week or weeks to really kind of work on this?
Right. Well, I know people have been thinking already, like, what is my role around, for example, police reform? So people can be thinking about that. Wherever any one of us works, there are things where we can say, just increase our curiosity and really think about how can we, are there ways that we can seek data or look for stories to help us get to a new horizon? But then on a personal level, I think just to bring it down to something totally doable, here's the homework for the week. Are you ready?
I am.
All right.
I am.
So today and this week, notice an assumption you made about someone or about a situation. In other words, the simple story that you came in with, and how were you proved wrong? What did you learn? How did that turn out not to be the whole story? So sit with that discomfort for a moment and consider what assumptions brought in. Did gender have anything to do with it? Appearance, language? And then consider what those assumptions were, and do you want to carry those forward with you or not?
Taking a look at your own personal data.
Yep, internal inventory of data, collecting measurements. Learning new things.
N of one, as we say.
An N of one, but, you know, a series of data collection points.
N of one.
Right. the N of one is who we actually have some control over.
Mm-hmm. Self-awareness.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming to my backyard today and having a conversation about this.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
See you, Fabric.
It's worth keeping this conversation going. Share this podcast with a friend, and you can find resources for discussions and other notes about this episode at our website, fabricmpls.com. You can also go to our contact page or reach out to us on social media to share your feedback and experiences, because Fabric isn't an organization sharing novel ideas. It's a community of people becoming more deeply woven. Thanks for being part of it.